Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and when African-Americans speak out against police brutality, the response from defenders of the criminal justice system as it is often that blacks are perpetually concerned about police violence while apathetic about black crime. President Trump's constant use of Chicago gang violence is a prominent current example. But my next guest writes in his new book that far from ignoring the issue of crime by blacks against other blacks, African-American officials and their constituents have been consumed by it, and this fixation on crime contributed significantly to some of the criminal justice policies that resulted in mass incarceration. James Forman, Yale Law School professor, tells this story in his new book through the lens of his time as a public defender in Washington, D.C., a district with black leadership at every level of its government. The book is titled Locking Up Our Own, Crime and Punishment in Black America. Professor Forman, welcome to WNYC.
Thank you.
Why did you feel it was important to write this book about African Americans' influence on mass incarceration?
Well, partially, I'm the kind of person who, when I go to a movie with friends and the movie's over, and if there are no black characters in the movie and people say, you know, what did you think about the movie? And I always say, like, where are the black characters? So in law, in history, in film, in theater, I always want to have African Americans at the center of the narrative. In this case in particular, there's a particular reason, which is I started my work as a public defender in Washington, D.C. in the 1990s. I had taken the job because I viewed it as the civil rights struggle of my generation. My parents met in SNCC, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and here I was as somebody with incredible opportunities available to me, clerking on the Supreme Court. And then I see one in three young black men in the criminal justice system. And so I think I need to go do this work because it's the criminal justice work of my era. I get to D.C. and what I see is a lot of people who don't necessarily agree with me. Some who did, but I had a number of cases. One I write about in the book, a young man facing a gun charge and a drug charge. And the African-American prosecutor was asking for him to be locked up. I was asking for him to be released. I had letters from teachers and counselors. The African-American judge who had to rule on the case, before he ruled, he looked into my clients, deep into his eyes. His name was Brandon. And he said, young man, Mr. Forman has been telling me that you've had a hard life. But let me tell you about hard. And the judge starts to talk about Jim Crow, and he starts to talk about segregation. And then he says, so see, here's the thing. People fought and marched and died for you to be free. And they didn't die for you to be out there running and gunning and thugging and carrying on and embarrassing your family, embarrassing your community. And he locked them up. And I thought, this judge is not alone. Let me tell the story, the complicated, nuanced story of how this African-American community came to support so many tough-on-crime measures.
So let me open up the phones, particularly for black listeners in this case, on that dilemma that Professor Forman is laying out, if you consider it a dilemma. On the one hand, you didn't fight against Jim Crow, or your parents or grandparents didn't fight against Jim Crow, so that today's kids could go out and commit crime. On the other hand, it's the new civil rights movement to deal with the excessive locking up of today's generation of young African Americans by the criminal justice system. 212-433-WNYC. Is it a dilemma for you? 212-433-9692. For Yale Law Professor James Forman, whose new book is Locking Up Our Own, Crime and Punishment in Black America, 212-433-9692. So you took the public defender job, seeing that as the front lines of the civil rights movement in the 1990s, and you were surprised by what the black prosecutor and the black judge saw as the same case. Did this influence your own thinking?
It didn't, in terms of, it didn't change my view that we've gone down the wrong path in this country, that we've gone down a punitive, harsh path, and that that has created devastation in so many pockets of America, especially in black communities. So that didn't change. It didn't change my view that what we need to have is a more humane, more restorative, more rehabilitation-oriented criminal justice system. Didn't change my view about any of that. The one area I'd say where my view did change is when I was a public defender and I was confronted with people like, you know, Judge Walker in this story, I was so angry at his position. And I assumed, I basically ascribed a kind of Uncle Tom sort of motives. I mean, I knew there were black people who supported these laws, but I was like, all right, well, they're kind of sellouts, you know? And when I went back to do the research and I went back to the 1970s and I saw the levels of crime and violence that the community was consumed by, the heroin addiction, right? The homicide rate tripled in D.C. in the late 1960s. It doubled in most other American cities. And then you get this newly enfranchised group of black elected officials, and they're struggling to do something, right? They need to respond. Their constituents are demanding a response. They're under this pressure. And so in a lot of ways, my story is about trying to put myself in the shoes of the people kind of at the time, like understand the world that that judge was confronted with.
Right.
So I have more sympathy, even though I have no more agreement.
And this came up, as I'm sure you know, in the context of the presidential race last year when Hillary Clinton was getting hammered by Black Lives Matter and other progressives for having been there when her husband signed the big crime bill of the 1990s that was seen as contributing so much to mass incarceration. Some of the pushback on that was that, well, a lot of local African-American officials in cities all over the country were calling for, or at least in agreement, that something had to be done because that times were different then. That was the height of the crack epidemic, or the 80s going into the earliest 90s. And crime was on the rise. And since then, crime has come way down. So it's time to view mass incarceration in a different kind of light. But that, you know, the idea was around that it's a revisionist take on history to say they never should have had that kind of conversation and never should have signed that crime bill in the 1990s because things were objectively really worse.
They were. And I guess I have two things about that. One is when we talk about these elected officials, I think one, the African-American elected officials in particular, one thing we have to be clear on is how almost every person I encounter is that's asking for more police and prisons and prosecution is also asking for an attention to root causes. They're also asking for a Marshall Plan for urban America. They're asking for more investment in schools, in job training, in mental health training, in housing, in fighting segregation. So I do think we have to be fair and admit that they didn't get that aspect of what they were asking for. They had an all-of-the-above solution, and they got really one of the above. The other thing I would say about Secretary Clinton is I watched that moment very carefully, and I understood what she was trying to say, but I wish she had said something a little bit different. I wish she had been a little bit more connected to that emotional pain of those protesters and said and tied into her own pain and said, you know what? Let me tell you where I was in the 90s, and let me tell you the pain and suffering and violence that I saw myself responding to. And you know what? That caused a lot of people to go too far, including me. And it caused us to say things that were wrong, and Super Predator was wrong. And I'm sorry, right? If she had done that, which is really kind of behind what she was saying, but she didn't say it like that. And I felt like if she had, people are prepared to understand, okay, you made a mistake. I get it. You were under pressure. And now you want to do different. Let's talk about that.
So she wasn't elected. Donald Trump was. He appointed Jeff Sessions attorney general. And now Jeff Sessions has appointed as one of his top deputies on crime this guy named Stephen Cook, who's calling pretty explicitly for a return to the era of mass incarceration. Here's 30 seconds of Stephen Cook from a Washington Post video.
What we did beginning in 1985 or along in there is put these laws to work. And what we did by putting them to work is we started filling the federal prisons, not state prisons, federal prisons with the worst of the worst. And what happened is exactly what Congress said they wanted to happen, and that is violent crime began in 1991, began to turn around. By 2014, we'd cut it in half. That's what the system is doing, and it's designed to do, and it's working exactly as it is.
Now, we've used that cut here before, but for those of you who haven't heard it, that is our new Deputy Attorney General, Stephen Cook. So get to know him, because it seems like he's very influential and there to implement a lot of what Jeff Sessions believes. So from your point of view and with your understanding of history, Professor Foreman, how much have those mass incarceration policies even been rolled back? And how much can a U.S. Attorney General restore it to the glory days of what he called, law enforcement policies in 1985?
Right. So I have two messages. One would be to Mr. Cook directly, and then one would be to the rest of us as citizens. So to Mr. Cook, I would just say that his use of statistics is wrong and is misleading. It is true that crime has declined, but it's also true that it's declined in many jurisdictions, including New York State, that have dramatically reduced the size of their prison populations. Still too large, still under terrible and in many cases kind of inhumane conditions, but we've seen many, many states where crime keeps going down as prison population goes down. So this idea that you have to have a rising prison population to reduce crime is just wrong. The other thing I would say to him is, even if it's true that rising incarceration rates are part of what explains the crime reduction, the question we always have to ask is, what's the most humane, least harmful way of reducing crime? So it would certainly, I think, be true that if you lock everybody up, then on the streets anyway, you won't have any more crime. You'll have crime in prison, but that, of course, we say, well, that's crazy. And so it's the same idea. Do we want to rely on prison, or do we want to rely on the kind of investments that actually reduce crime? But to the rest of us, which is really, I'd rather speak to the rest of us, because I don't think he's going to change his mind. To the rest of us, what I would say is, our problem of mass incarceration was one that was built fundamentally in cities, counties, and states, and not at the federal government level. And that's how we're going to have to reduce it. 88% of prisoners in this country are in state and local facilities, not federal prisons.
That's just what I was going to say as a follow-up. And he made that point. I don't know if you heard it, because you probably didn't hear that clip before. But he emphasized in federal prisons, mm-hmm. they did that with the worst of the worst, as he put it, not state and local prisons, at least as the Federal Justice Department was involved. And that same point came up in that same Hillary Clinton conversation during the presidential campaign, that Bill Clinton couldn't have been responsible for mass incarceration, because mass incarceration was overwhelmingly a state and local phenomenon, because the overwhelming amount of crimes, they're not federal crimes. All these drug crimes and stuff, mostly, and other violent crimes, mostly they're local crimes, and they're tried in state court. Is that true?
Well, it's true. That's partially true. It is true that cities and state governments are – that's where the prisoners are. That's where we incarcerate people. But – anybody who starts a sentence that says, I'm not responsible in this issue, I want to challenge them off the top, because we're all responsible. In my view, to say that, federal prisoners are 10 or 12%, so therefore I'm not responsible, first of all, ignores things like the incentives that the federal government gave, right? They gave certain money to states if they agreed to do things like get rid of parole. So the federal government can influence what states do. But really, the bigger picture is, we all built this system as a nation, in every city, in any county, across political lines, across racial lines. Some people bear more responsibility than others, but we all bear some responsibility, and that gives us all an opportunity. It gives us all an opportunity to participate in the rolling back.
We'll continue in a minute with James Foreman, Yale Law Professor, author now of Locking Up Our Own, Crime and Punishment in Black America. We'll take some of your calls for James Foreman right after this. Brian Lehrer, on WNYC with Yale Law Professor James Forman, author of Locking Up Our Own, Crime and Punishment in Black America. And by the way, so I don't forget, let me tell you that if you're interested in hearing more from him in person, he'll be at the NYU Law School Wednesday at 12:30 and John Jay College of Criminal Justice Thursday at 5 o'clock. NYU Law Wednesday, 12:30, John Jay Thursday, 5 p.m. Naja in Jamaica, Queens, you're on WNYC. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thank you for having me. I'm a longtime listener, first time calling, so yeah, thanks.
So glad you're on.
So, yeah, I just want to start off with the first question that you had. So I was actually living in D.C. A couple of years ago, attending Georgetown, and I was, you know, hanging with some people, allowed some of them to stay at my house because it was a really bad snowstorm, figured wait till the morning. So when I woke up, found that my PlayStation was about to be stolen, but my laptop was stolen. Long story short, I got my laptop back, and when the prosecutor asked me, well, what did I want to see happen to the young guy, I said, I don't want him to go to jail because, you know, like, I got my stuff back. I just want him to learn a lesson. So, like, probation, some kind of, like, anything, because he was explaining to me, well, oh, I have kids and I have to do this and I have to feed them. And I'm saying, that's not my problem. You know, that's unfortunate. And he was kind of saying to the extent of, well, you have everything. You have a place, you have a job. I'm like, I understand that. I'm struggling the same. It might be on a different level, but my struggle is just as tough. And so, like, I didn't want to see another person go to jail just for something simple. I got my stuff back. It's not that bad. And then even when, because I lived in Southeast D.C. for a little bit just because the rent was cheaper. And I just saw how they live. Like, a lot of them are, it's just like every person for themselves. Like, I have to do, you know, I have to do this. Or I have to steal. Like, a lot of that rhetoric was happening there. It's like, well, you know, and even just like the way how the city is made, like down there is just, it looks very different than, say, you go a little bit over into Capitol Hill.
So now, John, I'm going to jump in just for time. When you got to that point of seeing that the guy who stole from you was going to be come down on by the criminal justice system, you got ambivalent?
Well, yeah. Like, I, you know, when I actually had to face that decision, it was, well, you know, I want to see justice, but I also don't want to see, you know, another bad thing happened to a brother of mine, you know?
How'd it work out?
I don't know exactly, but it sounded like he may have gotten probation because he was still in contact with me, but I ignored him. But yeah, it seemed like it was just probation that he was on for some time, and then I left the where I was living and left the
right city.
And
that's an okay outcome as far as you were concerned?
Right, right. I'm fine. Like, my main thing was getting my computer back because I was in school and, you know, just him having some responsibility mm-hmm. for what he did and for his actions, regardless of the reason why.
Thank you so much for your call. Please call us again. Let's go to Kylie in Montclair. Kylie, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi. So I wanted to call because I was actually raised kind of with this tension my entire life. So my sisters and I grew up in Plainfield, New Jersey, and my dad and his friends would always have this constant argument about what to do with kind of truants and you know, bad behavior in schools. And my dad's perspective was always, you know, kick them out, lock them up. Like, I send my daughters to school. I need the schools to be safe. And his friend was always like, well, what is our responsibility as kind of middle-class Black people to these young men who are, you know, having this trouble? Like, we can't just kick them out. But my dad's perspective was, listen, we can talk about solutions, but not at the hands of my daughters. I send my daughters to the school. The school, the town needs to be safe. And so this tension has been present in my life, you know, since I was a child.
So Kylie lived the tension that you're writing about in your book.
Yeah, and Kylie, I feel like this book is written for you and for people like you. I mean, I hope everybody reads it. Of course, every author wants that. But you're who I have in mind, principally. That is to say, you know, African-Americans who are very aware of exactly this tension. And I feel like, you know, where I come down, ultimately, the message of the book, right, is a message of probably more towards your dad's friend in the sense of ultimately what I think the solution should be, more towards restoration, more towards keeping kids in school, more towards rehabilitation and restorative justice. But at the same time, of course, there has to be accountability. One of the things that I think is interesting is when you ask victims of crime, like for 40 or 50 years, we've basically built this rough, tough, brutal in many ways criminal justice system on the theory that this is what crime victims want. And it turns out when you do the research, if you tell most people that are victims of crime that they have a choice between prison or nothing, they take prison. But if you ask people, and the Alliance for Safety and Justice has done a lot of research in the last year interviewing crime victims, especially crime victims of color around the country, and what they say, what when they ask people if they have a, want a choice between prison or job training, mental health training, mental health treatment, drug treatment, those sorts of opportunities, people then say by a 2 to 3 to 1 margin, well, we want the problem fixed rather than have the person simply incarcerated. So I think that's kind of the work of the next decade, is building up some of those alternatives so that we can resolve that tension you described in a more kind of humane way, but that still makes the school safe for those that are trying to learn.
Kindly thank you and keep calling us. Just a little more of the history from your book before we run out of time. The list of black leaders who you mention supporting tough on crime policies might surprise some people. Maxine Waters was on this list, Johnny Cochran, Jesse Jackson, Eric Holder. And at the same time, you say that the idea from the 1960s that the solutions to crime included not just law enforcement, but job creation, better education, housing programs, et cetera, that such efforts had become an object of ridicule by 1975, a symbol of the hopeless naivete of 1960s liberalism. Do you think we've come full cycle to where those things aren't considered hopelessly naive anymore, but a central product, central project of, you know, contemporary civil rights movement?
I think we've opened up more space for that. And in part, the declining crime rates have made people, I think, a little bit more willing to have a conversation about mass incarceration and then about what are the other ways we can respond. Because I think that's, you know, fundamentally, like what I was saying to the last caller, we can't not have a response. That's not a plausible position to take when people are suffering and people are scared. So the question is, how are we going to respond? And I do think we're at a moment now where, yeah, people are willing to talk about healthcare and talk about mental health treatment and drug treatment. I mean, with the opioid crisis, and I know people have raised the, you know, and I've raised the kind of racial factors here. But with the opioid crisis, we see that, you know, very straightforwardly, people are starting to talk about the fact that, you know, we need treatment in these instances.
You want to give me maybe just 15, 20 seconds, because that's all we have on maybe a Jesse Jackson or an Eric Holder, who, you know, there are still people on right-wing radio going on and say, oh, they're the criminals lobby.
Well, Eric Holder was very, very tough on crime. He was the one that brought in this pretext policing where you stop people for any basis, any minor traffic violation, because you want to search for guns. And I think now he's seen some of the cost of that.
James Forman, Yale Law Professor, author now of Locking Up Our Own, Crime and Punishment in Black America. And again, if you want to see him in person, he will be talking about this stuff at the NYU Law School Wednesday afternoon at 12:30 and the John Jay College of Criminal Justice Thursday afternoon at 5 o'clock. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.